Good morning. Welcome to Backchat. I'm Danny Gittings, sitting in for Hugh Chiverton. Your co-host this morning is Mike Rouse. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Danny. The perfect subject for me this morning.
We'll get to that. In our main topic this morning, we'll be asking, does Hong Kong have too much government red tape and regulations? Critics fear the much-vaunted food truck scheme, which is subject to all kinds of restrictions that don't seem to apply to food trucks in other countries, that this scheme risks becoming the latest victim of excessive government bureaucracy in Hong Kong. And there's no shortage of other complaints about how too much government red tape affects our lives. From the rigid rules blamed for the failure of the Mega Events Fund to the complex procedures for restaurants to get approval for outdoor seating. But comparative studies claim our bureaucracy works well. And they're government bodies like the Efficiency Unit, whose boss is joining us for this morning's discussion, that work to make these things simpler and smoother. So what are your experiences of red tape in Hong Kong? Is it all the fault of the government, or should we also be blaming private businesses, such as the banks, who seem to make it as difficult as possible to open a bank account? Email us with your thoughts. Our email address, backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or you can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, and leave a comment there. Or give us a call. The number there, 233-88-266. That's 233-88-266. Later in the programme, another call for national education in Hong Kong schools. Joining us for the main segment of the discussion, as I mentioned earlier, is the head of the Hong Kong government's efficiency unit, Kim Saucold. We're also joined by David Webb, who's shareholder activist and founder of website.com. And we hope to be joined soon by Mark Michelson, who's the chairman of Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia. Good morning. Thank you for joining the show.
Good morning. Morning.
I think I'll go to my co-host first, Mike Rouse. Mike, you're a former civil servant.
I am. I'm still on the payroll. I'm a pensioner.
Oh, so you're a current civil servant. And you've had many experiences of government bureaucracy. So
it's a mindset issue. It really is. It's a safety-first approach because you know you're going to get clobbered if there's even a tiny incident. So people sit around with a bright idea. Bright ideas are dangerous in a government setting.
Bright ideas don't win you promotion, right?
They don't, because they leave you exposed if something goes wrong with it. So everyone loads on restrictions for safety's sake.
And then when you look at this food truck scheme, having been in the government for decades, I mean, there was a classic article in the New York Times poking fun at it, sort of saying,
this was so predictable. It's extraordinary. I mean, I feel for Kim and his job. This was so predictable. All right. Selling food informally, different setting. Mm-hmm. We used to call them hawkers. They were everywhere. What was special about the food truck concept? The whole idea of food trucks anyway is they go where the demand is. So they might be in one place in the morning, a different place at lunchtime, a different place in the evening. What did we do? Fixed pitches.
Okay. Let's go to David Webb first. David Webb, shareholder activist and founder of website.com. Now, this whole issue of the food truck scheme and one operator has already pulled out, and although they're not giving reasons now, they have said in the past that they were worried about too much red tape. There's been articles in the New York Times poking fun at the bureaucracy in the scheme. I mean, that's what it's brought it back to the fore. But David Webb, presumably you've got a broader perspective on this than just food trucks.
Yes, I mean, it's the whole idea was cooked up, as it were, by John Jang and his budget one year. I think he'd seen them somewhere else and said, how come we don't have them in Hong Kong? Well, there must be some regulatory reason why we don't. But we do, of course, have things like ice cream vans. They've been around forever. And as Mike pointed out, we have food hawkers cooking on the pavements in some areas. The bigger issue here is, why is the government getting so micro-involved in these things to start with? I opened my newspaper the other day and saw that the government is going to decree that certain pieces of land must have a cinema. It's now micromanaging what developers should do with their land. It has been doing that for some time in other areas, but what next? Are we going to say, okay, there's some votes in the movie industry, so we must have cinemas in this land. There's some votes in the religious sector, so each new shopping mall must have a mosque in it, and maybe a Catholic church and a Buddhist temple, but nothing for the Hindus or the atheists, because they don't have votes.
You complain, but when we look at the international surveys, I'm looking at here one, Hong Kong has the fourth most efficient government in the world. And we'll come to some examples in a minute, but they must be doing something right.
You have to look at what they're measuring and I think you're referring to the World Economic Forum study, which measures things like how long does it take to incorporate a company or apply for a business registration. And a lot of those things are quite straightforward. Those things don't concern me. They shouldn't take that long. What concerns me is the amount of intervention of the government in the economy. You mentioned the mega events fund and difficulty of getting money out of it. Well, why do we have the fund in the first place is my question. Why are we putting taxpayers' money into projects which are not otherwise commercially viable? Why do we have the movie fund? Why do we have the innovation and technology fund? People are going to innovate if there's money in it, if they can see a potential business opportunity. Why do we need to use taxpayers' money for that? Why do we need to have government guarantees of loans for small companies? Surely, if they're viable, their founders can either put in equity or borrow from friends and family or even banks if they've got enough cash flow. Why is it that we, the taxpayer, should basically keep watering the weeds and stopping the flowers from blooming on their own? So there's a lot of policy side of the government, which does get in the way of a smooth-running economy, misallocates capital, and it probably the biggest example of this is the land system, because it's the government who basically plays Farmville with our land supply and says, well, this piece of land at Kai Tak should be a hotel, or this piece of land should be a data centre at Chung Kwai No, rather than just saying to the market, what is your interest in this land? Why don't you just bid for it? We'll give you a limited plot ratio, the same as anyone else, and you can use it today as a hotel or tomorrow as a shopping complex or a residential development. That'll be up to you, and you won't have to come back to us and apply for a change of use in future.
But in fairness, it's not quite as simple as that, David, is it?
Yes, it is. You pay the highest amount.
For example,
based on
if you put a huge residential complex there and you've left that choice to the market, you're then going to have a demand for schools and clinics and other things that you wouldn't have necessarily if it were a hotel. A hotel is occupied by guests who come in.
Well, you probably won't get much residential sales if you don't have some schools in the vicinity. So then the demand for that site won't be residential. So you actually look at the developers will look at the site based on its highest economic value. They won't put a shopping mall in the middle of nowhere, for example, unless there's very good transportation facilities to it already.
Okay, we're in danger of getting into discussion on land policy here, which is certainly a relevant issue, but we're looking more broadly at the issue of red tape and efficiency in government, particularly after all the negative headlines about the recent food truck scheme, and is that subject to too many restrictions. If you have any comments, email us with your thoughts. Our email address is backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio Free, and leave a comment there. As I mentioned earlier, the Hong Kong government does have a unit which is specifically designed for enhancing efficiency, and it's got that name, the Hong Kong Government Efficiency Unit, headed by Kim Southcold. Kim Southcold is in our Queensway studio. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning.
Okay. Now, let's start with this. I mean, your job, the efficiency unit's been around for decades, hasn't it?
It's been around since the early 90s, and its remit is very much to look at processes within the government and try and improve those from the perspective of the citizen or the business trying to deal with government.
You've got a lot of fancy... We're looking at your website, there are a lot of fancy titles. There's business, process, re-engineering, things like that, right?
Yes, that's the internal government business process. I don't go out and tell food trucks how they should run their business.
Yes, but how about telling the bureaucrats who set the rules for the food truck scheme how to...
Well, I think you've got to draw a distinction between the rules and how things operate, the mindset. Rules are in place for very good reasons, because markets, when left to themselves, do things like poisoning people or killing them or poisoning the air and the water and the land that we need to live from, generally. There needs to be regulation that lays down minimum standards of safety and emissions and other things. And in a very crowded city like Hong Kong, you also need rules around fire safety and access on pedestrian ways. Again, why should a business, just because it wants to get more money, take over a pavement and force people to walk out on the street?
Well, we see that all the time happening in Hong Kong, don't we?
We see a lot of clamping down. The government has been pushing a very strong effort to retake management of the streets so that they can be enjoyed by people.
Sounds to me like you're defending the way the food truck scheme has been run.
I haven't got any particular comments on the food truck scheme. I've not been involved in that at all.
I understand. But
I would agree with the comment that it's something that there have been types of food trucks, ice cream trucks, around in Hong Kong for quite a long while. They seem to have operated okay. Why the scheme around the new food trucks was set out as it was, we haven't been asked in to look at that. All I'd say is that there are lots of considerations other than just the businessman wanting to get the most advantageous position, because there are other people in Hong Kong apart from businessmen.
And as head of the Hong Kong government's efficiency unit, how do you feel when newspapers like the New York Times run stories poking fun at Hong Kong about seven annexes of requirements? I presume you've seen this story, but seven annexes of requirements for how you run a food truck, and saying the Heritage Foundation may say this is one of the freest economies in the world, but most people in Hong Kong who live in Hong Kong would beg to differ, especially about efficiency in government.
Well, I would always, when I see huge amounts of regulation or very difficult forms for people to fill in, I take offence at it. And the job that we do is to try and go out and get departments to change the way that they communicate with the business or the individual or the family they're trying to deal with, to make it simple and straightforward.
They have been overly prescriptive in the food truck scheme, though. I mean, it almost said what the radius of the beef burger has to be. but they said you can't change your menus for X number of years after you've applied and got your license. And they had a bake-off. I mean, why not just, you know, if you're going to have a fixed number of allowed food trucks in Hong Kong, then auction them, have the highest bid and leave it at that.
Okay, we're now joined by Mark Michelson. Mark Michelson is the chairman of Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia. Good morning. Thank you for joining the show.
Morning, Danny.
I mean, the problems over the food truck scheme and all the bad publicity about it it's brought this issue back up, which is why we're doing it today. But it's about more than just food trucks, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. I've used a couple of the food trucks already and been pleasantly surprised by them. But you know, what it does is, and it's the same thing, I chair a group of regional CEOs of multinational companies, and they're beginning to complain too that Hong Kong has become more difficult to get things done within the government on non-controversial areas, on simple things where they just need brief approvals. Now, these are apocryphal, so you don't know if
why do you think that is? Government is broadly still, I mean, there's lots of civil servants, people who've been here for decades. It's broadly the same government it used to be.
Well, Mike will remember, and Kim might agree or might disagree, but certainly when I was in government, we spend a lot of our time lobbying within the government on behalf of our clients who were companies setting up in Hong Kong or running businesses in Hong Kong to try to get some of these things overcome, because a lot of things that were stopping them from getting rather simple approvals for things they needed to do were quite difficult sometimes. And it's my impression is it may have become a little bit more difficult as, you know, departments become more difficult to work with each other and so on. I don't know if that's true. It may not be completely, but certainly that's an impression a lot of people have.
I think on the food truck thing is a perfect illustration. I mean, there was some talk at the beginning that this was going to enable young people to start up in business.
Yeah.
And then with seven annexes or whatever it was of conditions, it immediately became impossible for any young person who wasn't from a very wealthy family to even look at it. You'd need consultants to advise you how to navigate it.
Well, the essence of food trucks is what David was just saying. It's an open market where you can sort of, yes, you have to have food safety standards and the rest, but in terms of where they set up and so on, as long as you aren't interfering in something, then you should be able to do that. And I talked to one of the food truck operators who said, well, we had to move by the harbor in Central, near where the Ferris wheel is. He said, but there's no traffic there. And, you know, build it and they will come, but I'm not sure it would happen this time.
Okay, we're discussing the issue of government red tape in Hong Kong on the back of the problems with the food truck scheme, but hopefully also broadening out discussion. If you have any thoughts, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk, or you can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio Free, and leave a comment there. Let me bring in a email from a listener, which says, simply titled, Red Tape Views from a Citizen. And it goes, Messrs. Rouse and Webb stated the mindset and the microcontrol are indeed true. Another problem is financial knowledge. Decisions essential in making decisions in the global world nowadays. But the majority of civil servants have not equipped or updated themselves in this aspect. Also, financial risks or macroeconomic thinking have not been factored much into government decisions, especially land use planning. Thank you very much indeed. If you've got any thoughts, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk.
I'd also like to throw Uber into the pot here, because we're surrounded in the region by economies like Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, which are not exactly models of, we think of advanced... they've all accommodated Uber. In fact, they have competition in this area. In Hong Kong, we arrested the drivers. Why is this?
Because the government wants to protect the speculators and investors in vehicle licenses, taxi licenses, rather than the public interest in having more choice in transportation. That's the bottom line here. And they've put out a very false and misleading paper to LegCo recently about their proposed premium taxi scheme. And it opens up with the line, the government issues taxi licenses based on demand. Which is a complete lie, because any premium at all payable for a license indicates surplus demand, and they haven't issued any new licenses since 1994, when the population has grown more than a million.
Webb, you're not... I mean, and we'll come back to Kim Salko in a minute on this, but you're not saying so much it's a mindset. You're just saying that they don't like the idea of competition,
They have a mindset that protects their vested interests, who elects them. The chief executive of Hong Kong is elected by various sectors.
So the problem
and
to
one
you
of those
is,
sectors is transportation.
It is not so much excessive regulation. It's just the wrong beliefs. I mean,
It's the wrong incentives, basically. If you have to pander to your electorate, whoever they are. If they're the general public, you pander to them. If it's a group of tycoons, you pander to them. What you've got in the transportation sector is numerous anti-competitive practices. If I want to drive a taxi for a living, I have to pay somebody else not to. I have to buy their license or rent it from them and stop them using it.
Okay.
If I want to drive a private hire car, there are only 650 of those licenses, and that has been the same for years and years. And even though, in fact, the law allows a cap of, I think, 1,500, but that wouldn't be enough. Yes, it's illegal to drive a car for hire without one of those licenses, but why should it be? Why should it be illegal for someone to do something perfectly safe, licensed and insured in a roadworthy vehicle for a living?
Okay, let me just interrupt briefly. The Philippines, you didn't mention the Philippines, but they changed their regulations to allow companies like Uber to operate. So they had to get insurance and do the rest of it. But they were regulated because they saw this as competitive. And certainly the Philippines are an entrepreneurial, competitive economy, to say the least.
Yeah, but we have – I mean, let me just go on about this a little bit more, because we don't just have a cap on the number of taxis and the number of private hire cars. We also have a cap on the number of red and green minibuses. The public light buses is 4,350 since 1976. Now, the population, again, has gone up about 2 million since then. The demand for transportation to get to the MTR from your residential development somewhere not near the MTR, you need that kind of intermodal transport, and there's only a fixed amount of it, and therefore it's no wonder that people, in order to get transportation at peak times, have bought private cars. So, you know, the government is wringing its hands about private car growth, but not releasing these caps, because the minibus licenses, again, now trade for about $3 million each. And similarly, in the non-franchised bus sector, these are the buses that do group tours, children's school runs, and residential shuttle buses. There's a fixed number of those now, 7,000, and that's caused a scarcity, and that's pushed up school bus fees. So more mums and dads are driving their kids to work or using other transport.
Okay, we're discussing the issue of red tape in Hong Kong and seeing how it affects pretty much everything. We started on land policy, and we're just on to Uber just now. A lot of criticism of the government here. Let's try and give Kim Salko, the head of the efficiency unit, a chance to redress the balance of it. I'm not expecting you to comment on the policy on Uber and so on, but maybe you tell us a bit more about what the efficiency unit tries to do in terms of, the title of your unit is to enhance efficiency in government.
Taking the area of food, one of the things we've been doing is working with the various departments who are involved in aspects of licensing to create for a business that's trying to set up a food business a single window that they can come to and a tracking scheme so they can see where their application is moving through. So from the user's point of view, it makes the process more transparent. From the department's point of view, it links up their information systems, enables them to see more quickly where there's being a delay or a problem and resolve it more quickly. Now, compared with processes in certain other countries, we're still a bit behind, and we do quite a lot of the benchmarking of ourselves against best practice elsewhere. But we can then, from that benchmarking, set a target. We want to try and achieve greater speed in throughput or greater certainty. I mean, very often for business, the key thing is not how quickly, but is it predictable?
Kim, this is great work. This must be at least the fourth or fifth go we've had at restaurant licensing. I remember funding two of them when I was in the business and services promotion unit.
When was that, Mike? 20 years ago?
Yeah, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And we keep coming back to it. And at that time, we found incredible things. Like there was a regulation that tiles in the kitchen had to be white. They didn't have to be clean. They had to be white. If you scraped the grease off and found a white one, that was okay. But if you had a spotless pink one, no, you failed.
When I think, Kim Salko, correct me if I'm wrong, you should say you can work on the processes and try and streamline the processes. You can't do so much about the regulations themselves.
Well, as I said earlier, the regulations themselves are there for a specific purpose.
I mean, how about the one Mike Rouse just cited? I mean, some of the regulations seem to be rather loopy, to put it mildly.
There are variations in the way that departments approach their licensing. Some of them take what I would describe, along with Mike, as an over-prescriptive approach. That if you do a particular piece of technology or a particular piece of fitting, that meets the requirement. Others are much more sensible. They take an outcome-based approach to the licensing, and things move a lot simpler, move a lot more quickly. And certainly the line we've always been taking to departments is look at your regulation and try and get to an outcome rather than a specification point.
Can you advise them to change or abandon regulations? Process-driven. You're trying to speed up the process.
That is our main remit. We can't advise them or direct them on policy or regulation, but our reports set out proposals that they can take up.
Do you have service standards, turnaround times for licensing and things like that?
Yes. I mean, there's performance pledges, and those were all part of the early reforms in the 1990s. What we're focusing more on, sort of seeing the problems that Mike has pointed out, if you sort of go and you improve the system but still problems emerge, is trying to get into the mindset of the people. And here our focus starts to move to the training that they're given, the leadership that they're given. And so we spend a lot more time talking with the Civil Service Training and Development Institute and the Civil Service Bureau about what are the approaches that should be coming down from the top to give permission to people at the frontline level to take initiative. Because what's happening all the time is that there's innovation taking place, both in technology and in people. And technology affects the way that businesses can operate, changes business models, changes the way that people deal with each other socially. Now, sometimes that creates a lot of objections to changes being made to government regulation. People who've got a vested interest, who are not necessarily the businessmen, but some residents are very happy with certain sets of restrictive regulation because it removes dispute from their street. Things just can't happen there. And with new technology, they can be much more in contact with both civil servants and their district councillors. So there's all this innovation going on in the city, and the processes of engagement, both with business and with the community, to try and resolve the tensions and the frictions that you get within a very heavily built-up city, need to evolve with it. And that's an area that I think the government needs to spend much more time investing in, those mechanisms of discourse and decision-making with a much better educated, informed and connected community.
Mike, what do you think of the work of the Efficiency Unit?
Well, I think at the level at which it's pitched and what it's trying to do, these are very worthy things. I'm really... there's a lot of mindset stuff still where. I mean, there's so many stories about mindset that you. I think
you've got to distinguish between the mindset of policymakers and regulators and lawmakers versus those who have to implement the laws and regulations they're given. I mean, Kim's unit is about implementing things within the regulatory and legal framework.
So would you agree, David Webb,
his
unit does good work then? It's just you're saying there are limits to it.
I have no dealings with his unit, I can't say that. but what I can say is that they're hampered by a lot of inappropriate laws and regulations. Those laws need to be either repealed or amended. For example, it is currently illegal to resell an entertainment ticket at a premium, which means that there's no market for ticket exchanges in Hong Kong. You have to do it underground. You have to sort of furtively offer things on illegal websites or something. Now, why should that be the case? Maybe the law was introduced years and years ago before the internet, where they thought there might be triads hanging out outside venues, somehow disturbing the peace.
Okay, we will continue this discussion after the news. You just heard there free market advocate David Webb talking about the restrictions in Hong Kong. We also have Kim Salko, the head of the Hong Kong government's efficiency unit, with us, and Mark Michelson from Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia. If you have any thoughts, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk. The weather forecast, it will be cool and mainly cloudy with one or two rain patches. The maximum temperature will be about 18 degrees. Currently, it's 16 degrees and the relative humidity is 73%. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back to Backchat. I'm Danny Gitting, sitting in for Hugh Chiverton. Your co-host this morning is Mike Rouse. In our main topic, we're looking at government red tape and regulation in Hong Kong. On the back of the recent controversy over the food truck scheme, which many people say is subject to excessive regulation. Our guests, Kim Salkold, head of the Hong Kong SAR government's efficiency unit, David Webb, shareholder activist and founder of website.com, and Mark Michelson, the chair of Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia. Later on in the program, we'll be looking at the latest call for national education in Hong Kong. If you have any thoughts on either of these topics, do email us at backchat.rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk, or you can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, and leave a comment there. Or, of course, you can always call us. The number there, 233-88266. That's 233-88266. Several comments coming in from listeners on our main topic. Let's go for a selection of them. As I mentioned, we did this show essentially on the back of all the recent bad publicity over the food truck scheme. But James writing in says, why single out food trucks, a harebrained idea which was doomed to fail in a city that's inundated with eating places? There are far more relevant issues that affect the everyday lives of the people of Hong Kong. Red tape, including the lack of communication between departments, is responsible for the perilous stage of our streets. Overcrowding, parking, filthy minibuses and taxis, and a host of our issues that impact us all. Hong Kong claims to be Asia's world city, but is stuck in an ever-deepening rut of its own creation. Mike, also on the issue of food trucks, says food trucks have been and still are in use in Hong Kong for many years. Every large construction site in the territory invariably has a food truck arrive, probably supplied by some Cha Chan Teng, every day to feed the site workers, who select and buy their lunch items from soup, sandwiches, noodles, water and drinks, etc. Then they disappear. The authorities know this, including the Labour Department and police. These trucks or vans can go anywhere, quite often more than one site, and supply what the workers want. Maybe they are legal, but the government could take a leaf out of these entrepreneurs' books and look at their supply and their very flexible operations. Rick, short and to the point, says, ask about opening a bank account for a new business. It's impossible and madness. World city, open for business, what a joke. Chris says, just listening to you talking about food trucks suggests you refer to the ongoing saga of the old police headquarters in Hollywood Road, and in particular the newspaper article last Saturday with Michelle Garneau complaining of the huge cost and effort she has incurred. It's all too difficult. And one last email, short and to the point, from Jaludin. Red tape enables our autocratic, non-democratic bureaucracy to rule over Hong Kong people without any accountability. If we're going to have a bureaucratic system, we need more democratic oversight. Thank you for all those comments. If you've got any further comments, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk.
Well, I think the bank thing is perfect because some of the
is that government or is it not government?
Yes, banking is perfect. There's nothing else we need to do, is there really?
Yeah. It's a perfect example. You've got regulation coming from the Monetary Authority. But then the banks, ordinary frontline people, are implementing. So one of the rules is proof of identity. Okay, that's fine for opening a new account. I remember writing about a story where a person had lost his bank card and therefore needed to close his account immediately in case someone used the bank card to get all the money out, and asked the bank to open another account immediately and transfer the money across, which the bank was happy to do, but then they wouldn't allow him access to the new bank account until he could produce his identity card, which in fact had been in the wallet that was stolen with the bank card. But he's saying, but you know it's me. Yes, but we have a rule that says we must see your identity document.
So what this is saying is the mindset's not just in the civil servants, is it?
It's where frontline people are worried that they're going to not have support from behind them.
So maybe we shouldn't be blaming government.
Well, he's probably thinking, you know, how do I know that you've lost your wallet? Yeah, you would say that, wouldn't you?
Yes. How do I know it's you? You know, it says here in my guide that I must see your identity card. Well, I haven't seen it, sorry.
Yep. Bring some other ID, I suppose.
So, David Webber, have we been too harsh on government here? This is a mindset that stretches well beyond government.
On banks, it only stretches to the banks because of the government. It's the government that imposes the anti-money laundering regulations, the Know Your Client regulations. And this is not just a Hong Kong issue, but globally, governments have imposed far too much of a responsibility to make bankers policemen, basically, and they shouldn't be. You know, if you're going to grow coca plants in Bolivia or Colombia, where I hear the crop has doubled recently,
you well informed about these matters?
That was on the radio this morning at your station. If you're going to do that, then that the banking system isn't going to stop you. What they do stop is legitimate people opening accounts, running businesses, and asking inane questions, even when you try and send money to your mother, as I do sometimes. You know, I get questions from a banker saying, why is this money being sent? Who is this, Mrs. Webb? Not putting two and two together. And it's no wonder then that people are starting to look for alternatives to move money around the world, even though they're not very viable, like Bitcoin. Rather than deal with the banking system. So that is a problem. It's even harder, as Mark's about to tell you, probably, if you're American, because then they want to know all about your tax affairs as well.
Okay, well, let's leave that for another time. Let's bring some more comments from our listeners. Red tape is clearly something that touches us all in our daily lives. A lot of comments coming in this morning. A couple more emails. Joe, describes himself as Joe Average, says, when I had a restaurant in China 10 years ago, all five or even seven licenses were linked together on the government computer, and they talked to each other. If you did your paperwork, step 1, 2, 3, it all fitted together. China was more advanced 10 years ago. And Gladys says, until the top civil servants and ministers travel by public transport, not AM cars, and buy their own toilet rolls, things will not improve. Thank you very much. Kim Salko, do you travel by public transport?
I do.
So you?
He's not a minister.
I won't ask.
What about toilet rolls?
I won't ask that part of the question. You understand the perception people sometimes think that civil servants, which has been highlighted by Kerry Lamb's comment about toilet rolls, it has to be said that civil servants are sometimes out of touch with everyday problems in life, which could include bureaucracy.
Or how to use an octopus card in the MTR.
Telling people to stop.
Let's give Kim a chance.
Which
to
slot
respond.
Do I put my octopus in?
It is vital that the people who are serving the community are able to put themselves into the shoes of the citizens or the business that they're serving. And that means going out and walking around. And periodically there have to be reinventions of the way that government operates. And back in the 70s they created the City District Office Scheme to get more district office people out onto the streets, talking with people, understanding the problems and trying to deal with them. over the past 20 years, we've put a lot of focus onto how do you get value for money? You strip out overheads and things. What we and various other governments who've gone down this route have begun to realise is that by doing too much of that, you strip out the capacity and the time that people can take to go and talk to those that they're supposed to be serving and resolve complex issues. And as I said earlier, the kinds of issues, even around restaurant licensing, 40 years ago, the transaction process was very simple. There was just the regulatory agency, the restaurant applying, perhaps some ombudsman who'd sort of check up, but citizens didn't often get very much involved in it. Now, the position is much more complex. People are online with all sorts of websites doing all sorts of things and engaging with the community, engaging with district councillors. For the person who's responsible for decisions about licensing, it's a much more complex environment, and they need to be given support and directions to how to operate in that complex environment.
So it's a more complex environment because it's easier for citizens to respond than in the past. In the past,
it's not just citizens, it's special interest groups. The whole, if you sort of map out the web of connections that there now are in a decision about licensing, it's, my point is simply, it's a very much more complex web than it was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And this is why governments sort of need to be thinking about not just the regulation, but also the process of that negotiation that enables a decision to be taken reasonably and fairly for the community and in a reasonable and predictable amount.
For example, because your competitor can object to your license.
Yeah.
Things like this. So
what are we saying here? It was easier in the past when civil servants could take decisions without sort of having to worry about people necessarily knowing about the implications or being able to make their views felt.
To a degree, yes.
You miss those old days, Mike, back in the when you first arrived in Hong Kong in the 70s. You could sit in your ivory tower and...
I'm not as old as that, and I do travel by public transport every day.
And you know how to use an Octopus card.
I absolutely do. I've got my special one. I only have to pay $2 for anything.
I think there is a key point raised there that if you are chauffeured around because you've reached the upper echelons of government and you don't have to deal with a public transport system, or you... Or you're a tycoon who has a private driver, or even a fairly wealthy person who has a private driver, then you don't have to deal with all of the other issues that the rest of the population has to deal with dealing with the public transport system. And you tend not to think about, well, does it really matter if we don't have private hire cars? Surely 600 premium taxis ought to be enough for anyone. After all, that's one for every 10,000 people in Hong Kong, isn't it? So
that's absolutely correct. And I remember the minister's comment that people say we can't get onto the MTR because of all the people with suitcases. The answer was, wait for the next train. This is obviously a comment that came from someone who's never been on the MTR in Russia.
That's right. Well, this ivory tower, this goes back to one of your commentators from one of the emails about democracy, and it maybe doesn't solve all problems, but the example of the first George Bush, George H.W. Bush, when he was running against Bill Clinton, and he was in a supermarket and was amazed that the checkout people put the items next to something and it beeped and the price came up. And he'd never seen that before. And, that probably – it didn't cost him the election that alone, but it didn't help.
Okay, let's go back to the issue of regulation, because early on we were talking about how you can try and change the mindset, and I think Kim Salcote said efficiency unit do work on processes and so on, but regulations is a different matter. Now, of course, Donald Trump in the US has come in with much fanfare with this idea that for every one regulation, new regulation you create, I think you've got to scrap two. Is that the sort of... hesitate to suggest we should adopt anything Donald Trump is proposing.
It sounds good, although I think if you don't stop, you end up with zero or a fractional number of regulations. So, diminishing return.
How about another suggestion for sunset clauses? That every a set of regulations should automatically expire after 5 or 10 years unless revalidated.
Well, also, particularly when you're messing with the economy, like with special stamp duty, double stamp duty, buyer's stamp duty, every kind of stamp duty you can think of to try and manipulate the property prices having no effect. But none of those have sunset clauses. And if they did, would you really get the legislators, including the government ones, pro-government ones, to approve renewal of those arrangements? I suspect not.
Kim Salcote, how about that idea of
regulation. I know you're more sort of process-driven, but you have views on these matters. Regulations with sunset clauses to help make us more efficient?
Certainly, regulations with sunset clauses have been used to some effect elsewhere. Whether it produces more efficiency from a process point of view, or whether it simply enables innovation to take place in the market, so that's sort of external efficiency, I'm not sure. It's not an area that I've looked into greatly. What I am certain about is that there is vast scope for undoing knots in current regulation, getting people to go back to the basics of what is the intention, the public purpose of this regulation? Safety of people, protection of them, prevention of nuisances or whatever. And is there a better way, given modern technology or modern society, of achieving that objective without some of the constraints that are imposed by the existing prescriptive regulation?
From what I understand in what you said earlier, that's not really your remit at the moment. Are you suggesting that's something that there should be a unit, whether your unit or another one, should be tasked looking at that?
It's not an area that I can demand that a department change, but in the reports that we do on their business process, if there are regulatory changes that we think are necessary in order to achieve an improvement, we make those recommendations, but it's then for them to take that forward with the legislative process.
I have one comment on sunset clauses. Obviously, in situations where the regulations are set to change something and it does change in the way that the regulation had intended, then it should have, you would think, a sunset clause that maybe it's not even needed anymore. But the ones that, just to go back to what you were talking about, what's been proposed in the U.S., a lot of those regulations that Kim were talking about earlier that have to do with air and water and other areas like that, which, you know, if you believe in regulations at all, you sort of need those in some cases. Otherwise, they will be violated massively, especially by certain people who run certain agencies in the United States.
Okay, we started with the food truck scheme. Let's go back to that just as we move towards the end of the discussion. David Webb, how would you save the food truck scheme? I know it's not your particular field. I know you'd rather talk about land policy, but that's what people are focusing on.
Look, it should not be illegal to carry on any business that does no harm to anyone else, right? So if you want to run a food truck...
But Kim Salcol would say that if the kitchen cooks up something
right,
without
so
safety...
Let me finish. So let me finish. Of course, you still need to have the... laws on hygiene and so on, but and laws against illegal parking. You can't just roll up in the middle of Queen's Road Central, block a lane and start serving hamburgers. But if you're not doing any harm to anyone else and you're not illegally parking and you are complying with the laws on food preparation or whatever, then set your own menus, set your own prices, serve whoever you want, drive around and find the best location, don't have prescribed locations, because these are food trucks that can't truck. You know, they can't move unless the government says they can, and it's their turn to move to the new location, and that's a government-selected location, just like they're now selecting locations for cinemas, they're selecting locations for food trucks, rather than letting the free market economics determine how many there should be, where they should be. So they need to scrap this approach altogether, but encourage those businesses to... you know, and remove any unnecessary regulatory barriers in their way.
Kim Salcold, I know you were not involved in the food truck scheme, but are there lessons to be learned from it and also from more sort of the general perception of how it's been introduced?
There's always lessons to be learned, and that's what we try and create, learning organisations that will see problems that are caused and think about why that's arisen and is there a better way of doing things.
And are there any particular lessons you can draw? You're talking in generalities there.
I have to, because in this case I don't know at all, other than what I read in the papers, and one has to be a little bit careful about what appears there, about the scheme. So,
Mark Michelson, if you could change just a couple of things about the way the government handles these things, what would you suggest?
Well, I think just to be more flexible and realistic, I know that sometimes is a tall order, but I mean the food trucks, and I agree with some of your comments that you've received that maybe not the most important issue in the world, and there's a question whether even Hong Kong's a great place to have it, but it's not for the government to make that decision. I think it's for, as David has said, it's for them to try out, to be given the flexibility to be able to do that. And, you know, we've mentioned Uber. We've mentioned a lot of other areas where this could actually benefit Hong Kong in many ways. And I think that's one of the major things. And also, in this case, a very practical thing, and I know Kim works on this, the efficiency unit does do good work. They often don't have a champion within the government that's going to carry it forward. But in terms of the various departments sometimes working against each other's interests, and then the company or the individual that's trying to move forward can't. You know, so that's...
Yeah. Kim, do you feel you've got a champion? What happens if the department ignores your report?
Well, you have to be your own champion and go out and keep trying to stick your foot in the door and keep hammering away, and eventually things will happen.
Okay, well, good luck with that task. Thank you very much to our guests on looking at the issue of red tape and efficiency in government this morning. You just heard Kim Saucode, who's the head of the Hong Kong SAR Government's Efficiency Unit. Also, Mark Michelson, the chairman of Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia. And David Webb, a shareholder activist and founder of website.com. Thank you very much also to all our listeners who emailed in with their own comments and experiences on a red tape. Let me just bring in just one more email. Says, after the museum saga, if Carrie Lam is elected, the Empress will have new clothes every day. Be prepared for more red tape. Thank you very much. Mike, there does seem to be sort of feeling that Carrie Lam, it would not be the right person to cut through government red tape.
I don't know. It was John who devised the food truck thing.
True, actually. I mean, Carrie's the one who makes the public blunders and people can make
all of this up. Makes me think Judge Wu has an outside chance.